Hey, welcome to our podcast, Sounding Off with Kim Munson. Be sure and check out our website. That is kimmunson.com. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. Go over to Facebook. We'd appreciate it if you'd give us a like. And be sure and sign up for our weekly newsletter as well. We've got a lot of great information and typically roll these podcasts out there. Thrilled to have in studio with me my friend Stephen Kessler. Stephen, welcome to the podcast.
Kim, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, Stephen.
Sure. So I got my doctorate from the University of Rochester in higher ed administration, which is basically a doctorate in social justice, and didn't quite stick. Long story short, like a lot of people, spending this much time with the far left made me conservative, and I'm now a conservative scholar. I'm a Russell Kirk Fellow. I'm the Edmund Burke Society Fellow at the Kirk Center, and I'm really lucky to be here and excited.
Well, and you also write for a number of different publications as well.
Yeah, sure. You can check out a lot of my work in places like The Imaginative Conservative, The Vogelin View, The American Thinker, and I have a piece coming up this fall, summer. I'm not sure when it's going to be released, for the European Conservative Magazine in print edition. Okay. So, yeah, that's a lot of where my stuff is.
Okay, and you're working on a manuscript for a book.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I have a manuscript for a book. The book is called In the Beginning, The Liberal Book of Genesis and the Creation Myth of Liberalism. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the thoughts, themes, and ideas I have for the book.
Well, and it's very timely. With all of the narratives that are going on in America right now, there's been a real romance with quote-unquote socialism, and you really break that down, Stephen. So let's start with that, socialism. What's
sure.
your comments?
Sure. So I'm going to start with, I'm going to take it a step back and not start directly with socialism, but rather start with the foundations that socialism is built on. So the premise of my book is the following. Jean Rousseau is the godfather and patron saint of liberalism. Almost all liberal thought comes from Rousseau. So some of you may be familiar with him from writing The Social Contract. We all learned about it in social studies or history, whatever we had when we were kids in school. That's his most celebrated and famous work, but truth be told, it's really just the tip of the iceberg. If you really dig into Rousseau's work and thought, you will learn that he really is the godfather and patron saint of liberalism, and that almost all liberal thought comes from him. The foundational premise of his thought, liberalism in general and socialism specifically, he invalidated the Christian doctrine of original sin. So for those of you at home that don't know what original sin is the story from the book of Genesis in the Christian Bible. God made the world. He created the Garden of Eden, which was this utopia. He made the first two people, Adam and Eve, and he said, don't eat from the tree of knowledge or the tree of life, and you can live in utopia forever. They ate from the tree of knowledge, sinning, which was the first and original sin of man. God then expelled us from utopia on earth, and that's what original sin is. Now, in the Garden of Eden, everything was provided for us. There was no concept of scarcity. There was no concept of labor. And the human condition was utopian and not tragic. Now, labor is the punishment for original sin. God said Adam must labor by the sweat of his brow, and Eve must labor via childbirth. Mm-hmm. I was patting my tummy. I realized nobody could see that. So
just a quick question, though, because we talk about liberal educations, the kind of the classical liberal education, and that is different from this liberalism that you're talking about. So can you explain that, Stephen?
Yeah. Actually, I've written some scholarship in the Journal of Liberal Arts and Sciences explaining what actual liberal arts is and liberal education. So liberalism and the liberal arts have nothing to do with one another. The liberal arts are defined best in terms of what they are opposed to. Their diametric opposition is the mechanical arts. The mechanical arts and the liberal arts are both based on labor, once again. Now, the mechanical arts are what we would consider blue-collar labor, manual labor, you know, the sweat of your brow, the sweat of your hand, and the sweat of your mind. That labor has traditionally been viewed as base or vile. Why? because of original sin in the Christian tradition.
Interesting.
And so that the liberal arts are what we would call spiritual work, work that pertains less to the hand and more to the mind. And because of that, because of this whole concept of original sin, it's a belief that man's nature is fundamentally flawed, and therefore that nature necessitates restraints. For when the restraints on man's unruly passions and appetites are removed, they run amok. And so the thrust of the liberal arts is channels, stories that will teach you what happens when people fail to exercise appropriate self-control. For when the restraints, once again, are removed, they run amok. And we need that restraint to channel our unruly passions and appetites.
Well, that kind of liberalism, if you will, was steeped into the founding of America.
Wait, you mean what I'm saying about the liberal arts?
Well, as far as restraint.
Oh, self-control, checks and balances.
Yes.
100%. That's what the thrust of the Constitution is. And if you were to dig in a little bit deeper, you would notice that in the Federalist Papers, they really explain what they're talking about. I didn't actually anticipate discussing this, but it's worth talking about. So the liberal arts lost their prestige with Rousseau because he invalidated the Christian doctrine of original sin. And that's what made the liberal arts less valuable, and it made the mechanical arts more their equal. This whole notion of self-control and restraint, I address that in my book in great detail. So Rousseau not only invalidates original sin in his own mind and heart, but what he really does then is he transfers the struggle for good and evil, the flawed nature of man that was in the breast of the individual, that was sewn into the fabric of the human condition. He says, nah, human beings were born benevolent, but we were corrupted by society. He then transfers that flawed nature of man from the breast of the individual, you know, the angel on this shoulder and the devil on this one, to society. Now we just have the angel on one shoulder, nothing on the other, and society. By fixing society, we can then fix the problems of this world. In the same way that we would treat COVID, cancer, HIV, we would treat like a disease, we can treat the problems of society in the same way.
But it's not possible.
Oh, no, it doesn't work because it doesn't come from without. The problems come from within. They come from the fact that the human condition is tragic. Stuff happens.
Well, and so then that goes to the founders, because the founders understood this concept of original sin, that we need to have checks and balances because humans are imperfect. And so that is why that is Rousseau. They did not base, I mean, I think they read Rousseau, didn't they?
Oh, everybody knew Rousseau. He was huge. He was as big a guy. He was a rock star in his age.
Okay.
He's a baffling character as a human being, too, because he was insanely popular in his own time. He really broke the mold when he wrote a book called Julie or the New Eloise. People were checking that book out by the hour. It was so big, he became famous, beloved, and yet the more beloved and famous he became, the more unhappy, and I have trouble pinpointing exactly who he is mentally. He's not Edmund Burke, who was the original conservative, who had like real firm principles. Rousseau was a whiny victim, and he was the original liberal malcontent. Never happy with society, always unhappy with his portion, always blaming others, doing everything in his power to get out of responsibility and commitment.
Okay, so that, what I see the theme there is, then there is this idea that, you know, on the radical left now, is that life is made up of victims and oppressors. Mm-hmm. So that seems like where
Correct.
He would be.
Correct. He is the original architect of this, and I address this in my manuscript. For those of you out there, I'm looking for an agent or a literary agent or a potential book publisher, but I address this in my manuscript. Now, because Rousseau transferred the struggle for good and evil from the breast of the individual to society, what he did was he eradicated all forms of agency. I didn't steal from that store. Society made me do it. I didn't punch that guy. Society made me do it.
I didn't destroy that statue.
Yeah.
Society
made me do it. I'm a product of society.
Too young for this, but there used to be a show called Laugh-In. Flip Wilson.
I don't know who that is, but
okay.
I'm familiar with
Flip Laugh-In. Flip Wilson, and He was a black guy. He was so funny. And he did these different characters. And he would talk about doing something that, you know, was wrong. And he'd say, but the devil made me do it. Never took responsibility for his own actions.
Mm-hmm, correct. And because we aren't responsible for our choices, our portions and choices are therefore dictated to us. Some of us are dealt a winning hand. Most of us are not. And because
this is Rousseau's attitude.
Yes, yeah, 100%. Yeah, yeah. There's a great book called Men and Citizens by Judith Schlarl, who S-H-K-L-A-R-L. She's deceased now, but a Rousseau scholar. And she once wrote in a paper, he is the Homer of the losers, meaning the epic poet. He just appeals to the loser in people. He has that bad attitude of, I'm not good enough, why compete? Kind of.
But if I'm not good enough, you shouldn't be good enough either.
Correct, correct. And he talks about basically how, because you will hurt his feelings by being better than him, because shame, envy, comparisons, those are all things he's trying to eliminate from the world. And he wants to get rid of the things that cultivate and foster them. He has this just a loser's attitude throughout his entire life. And there's so much evidence that suggests that.
Well, now, Stephen Kessler, how does that move into contemporary narratives then?
It's the foundation of all of it. If you really want to understand contemporary politics, you have to understand Rousseau. And I think it's important to understand the liberal book of Genesis. Now, I'm going to explain really what the thrust of my manuscript is, and I'm going to explain how this is the liberal book of Genesis. So Rousseau not only invalidated original sin in his own mind and heart, meaning his personal life, he went a step further. He invalidates the original creation myth from the book of Genesis. Chapters like 1 through 3 from the book of Genesis, he says, nah, it didn't happen. I'm going to tell you what happened. And he outlined this creation story for man, his creation story, in great detail in an essay he wrote called The Discourse on the Origin of Inequality, a.k.a. The Second Discourse. Excuse me.
Okay.
The Second Discourse is the original book of Genesis. Is the liberal book of Genesis, and it contains the original creation myth for liberalism.
And what is that?
So Rousseau postulates that man lived in his version of the Garden of Eden, which was a pre-civil society, quote-unquote, state of nature. And in this state of nature, we were naturally equals. There was no concept of labor, scarcity, and the human condition was utopian, not tragic.
Okay, so how's that playing out now?
Okay, so in the state of, well, let me just... computer went to sleep here. I got some of the information. So in the state of nature, human beings were equals. This is what Rousseau said. Having had the good fortune to be born among you, how could I meditate on the equality which nature has established among men and upon the inequality they have instituted? So liberals believe that we were naturally equals and that we are naturally equals, but that natural equity was corrupted by society. By fixing society, tinkering with laws, customs, traditions, norms,
rules, regulations,
yep.
Ordinances, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, things of that nature. We can restore the natural equity of man.
But what I find so interesting, Stephen Kessler, is that in restoring this quote-unquote equity of man, it really picks the elites and everybody else. So they're not totally quote-unquote, utopian equal.
Oh, no. Equity is a fool's errand. We are born first and foremost into families. And in the family unit, we are socialized into hierarchy. It goes parents up top, kids down at the bottom. Siblings have a hierarchy to them. You know, older siblings do things that younger ones don't. Especially if there's a larger age gap, you know, 7-8 years. The older ones are taking care of the younger ones, and that's just life. Mm-hmm. And so that's why liberals who believe That's why liberals believe equal results are possible, because we're equals to begin with.
Okay, but how does that is a little different than this vision of the Declaration of Independence for America, which that all, you know, all men are created equal. So there's a difference between created equal and being equal, right?
I think it's about opportunities and results. I think what we're really saying is that, hey, we're all created equal before the eyes of God, and therefore we have all these same opportunities to excel, but we can't expect equal results. They actually address that in the Federalist Papers, that if they tried to make people equals, it would be a disaster.
Do you remember which Federalist that is?
I can look it up right now.
Okay. So while you're doing that, or taking a look at that, so there is this narrative out here with this contemporary romance on socialism that we should have equal outcomes. And we see so many younger people that have been taught this in our education system, and that if, in fact, there is not an equal outcome, then something that they might be bad if they're excelling or, trying to come to an equal outcome. So what's your thoughts on that, Stephen?
Well, I'm sorry, I was just looking at stuff. Would you mind repeating it quickly?
Well, on equal outcomes, many of our kids are being taught that we want to get to equal outcomes. And many of our suburban kids, you know, that's a lot of people that have been actually protesting on the whole George Floyd thing, Black Lives Matter, has been a bunch of suburban kids, which I found really interesting because they have not really been taught that you can't have equal outcomes. We want to protect that that opportunity that people can have to go out and compete and thrive.
Sure.
And prosper. So what would you say to that?
So what they're really being taught is a lot of Marxism. For those of you that are at home listening, Marxism is the philosophy of Karl Marx, the Communist Manifesto author, along with his colleague Engels. And one of the things that Marx and Engels talked about was you have to destroy certain things that perpetuate inequality. One of the things that they talk about repeatedly is they have to destroy individuality. Because if we're individuals, we can only be held accountable for our own individual actions. But by destroying individuality, what it does is it strips the individual of their individuality, and it then sort of, the stripper is then allowed to dictate what the strippee has become. And so what they say is, you know, they don't make it about your individual personal choices and actions anymore. You're just defined as a monolithic entity. And so inequality becomes rich versus poor. Race becomes black versus white. And that no one is therefore held accountable for their individual choices or actions. And that some people are poor and they struggle and they don't do as well, yes, because they were born into difficult circumstances. That's 100% true. But it also neglects the fact that some people are poor, some people are in trouble, some people don't do as well in life because maybe they lack the tools, maybe they make bad choices, maybe they have trouble with self-control, or maybe they just got victimized by bad luck. You know, every now and then, imagine there's a tornado and it destroys one home on the street.
But people can rebuild.
Oh, no, they can.
In the American idea, people can rebuild. They're not stuck in that victimhood.
Oh, sure. I was just getting at the fact that sometimes bad luck happens.
It does.
That was the point of the tornado example. And that's a lot of the Marxist ideology, that we're stripping individuality. Now, what's important to make a note when it comes to Marxism in contemporary politics and contemporary culture, it's coming on a pivot. Karl Marx was all about economics. He says that it's all about abolishing private property. That's what communism is in a nutshell. But unfortunately for Marx, and fortunately for us, economic Marxism failed, and it wasn't working exceptionally poor. It was exceptionally poor here in the States. So two, we'll call them intellectuals, Antonio Gramsci and Georg Lukács, one was Italian, the other was Hungarian, they said, hey, what if we took economic Marxism and we pivot and we make it about culture? And so what we're getting right now is not economic Marxism, but much more cultural Marxism. And I believe that in cultural Marxism, Not only is it about the abolition of individuality, but the other is about the abolition of enduring permanent truths. What they, you know, there are no truths. There is no objectivity. There are no facts. There is no order. You may say it goes 4, 5, 6, 7, but that's not true. It goes 7, 5, 6, 4.
And to that, then, that is something that we have seen in our society for a number of years, and that is relativism. That there is no, you have your truth, I have my truth. You may think that counting is 1, 2, 3, 4.
Exactly.
But I think that it's 5, 4, 3, 2. You may think that 2 and 2 equals 4, but I may think that 2 plus 2 equals 5. Well, when we look at that, it's just not true. No matter whether or not you think 2 plus 2 equals 5, 2 plus 2 equals 4.
Correct. And so I actually wasn't going to bring this topic up, but we've kind of meandered over there. You take the abolition of these enduring permanent truths, and you combine it with the natural equity of man, and you have the basis for the most important phrase in social justice, predicated on power structure. And what predicated on power structure means is that because you and I are naturally equals, and because there is no truth, everyone's opinions are just as good as the next person's. So you may say that it's 4, 5, 6, 7, but that's just your opinion, and there's no truth behind it. So therefore, the only reason that we would establish 4, 5, 6, 7 is because you're bigger and stronger than me, and you're forcing it on me, aka predicated on power structure.
Oh. And that seems like that might be moving to this white privilege narrative then.
Correct. And so the concept of privilege is actually quite sound, that because of different perspective, because of different demographic characteristics, we have different experiences. If every woman wore a Muslim hijab, every guy wore a Jewish yarmulke, and everyone was in a wheelchair, we would have different cultural and personal experiences. That is totally sound, and I'm not arguing the concept. But what they do is they have this balonium, you know, weapons-grade balonium ideology supporting it, where it's quote-unquote predicated on power structure. And because white men, able-bodied, cisgendered heterosexuals, we are all in power, therefore we're the only ones who are capable of having privilege, appropriating culture, or being racist. And so what that...
It's just not true.
Correct. Anybody can be a bigot. I mean, that's all there is to it. But the ideology is flawed. So to understand what predicated on power structure means in action, I'm going to give you two examples. The first has to do with reproductive norms, and the second has to do with hair, predicated on power structure.
Okay.
So male-female reproductive norms. A guy who sleeps around is a stud. A woman who does so is loose. They say predicated on power structure, right? Because men are the patriarchy. We're bigger and stronger. We're forcing these norms on women. And there's no truth to them. We're all equals. And therefore, it's predicated on power structure. Now, the conservatives or the people with, I don't know, people who believe in biology will tell you something different. They'll say men have an unlimited supply of sperm and biologically speaking can never know if they're the fathers of the children. Therefore, they look to reproduce widely. Women, on the other hand, become pregnant. And because women foot the bill, they become pregnant. They're dealing with the costs. They have to be much more prudent with the people that they reproduce with. Because if they choose to sleep with a guy who's a bum, who's going to run out, who's going to skip town, who can't hold down a job, who can't help provide, that's a bad choice, right? Mm-hmm. So women therefore look to reproduce wisely. Uh-huh. And so that's the biology behind it. Whereas they would say men and women are equal, they're bigger and stronger than women, therefore it's predicated on power structure. They're forcing these norms on them physically.
Okay, so interesting though, maybe this is for another podcast, because on one hand, you're talking about this predicated on power structure,
sure.
But yet on the other hand, they say that there is no male-female, that, you know, that there is no, you know, difference, no truth. So, I mean, it just doesn't match up, Stephen Kessler.
Oh, no. There's so much contradiction to it, and it's all just nonsense. I mean, it's really all you have to understand is the natural equity of man and the abolition of enduring and permanent truths.
Well, and I think that that's why our society is in this interesting time, because this hasn't just happened. This has been percolating underneath. You've been in the college settings for quite some time.
The trenches.
You've been in the trenches. And so this didn't just happen overnight. This has been percolating for a number of years.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So it's all coming. I think the biggest perpetrators of this offense are not the sociology departments. They're not the African studies departments. Those departments are small, and the radical professors, their influence isn't as big as you'd think. The real menace, the real perpetrators, are the graduate schools of education, for one real simple reason. If you're an employee on a college campus, you can likely go for free, 100% for free, to enroll in a program of higher ed administration, which is what my doctorate is in. And so all of these employees, the real trenchies, the people that are really out there, meat and potatoes, college administrators, perpetuating the propaganda in residential life, in the where the kids are living, the people doing student affairs, sororities, just all of these people are going on for master's degrees in higher ed administration, and that's where the real indoctrination is, and that's where the most people are coming out of.
Interesting. They're coming out and they're either teaching children or they're figuring out curriculum or something.
Well, I meant on our colleges, they're the employees. That almost all the administrators in every program and department, they can go on for free. So almost every college will give you two classes a semester for free to enroll in any program as a part-time student.
So does that mean those professors and those classes that you are enrolling in are not getting paid, that they're giving their services for free? Aha.
No. Some schools actually exchange real dollars,
Yeah. Believe
it or not. So if you're an employee at the business school and you work in their enrollment and admissions, you can some school, and then you enroll in the School of Education, some universities actually transfer real dollars for the bills.
Yeah. So my point, though, is Stephen Kessler, is the student may be getting it for free, but the professor, and they may be espousing socialist tendencies, they're not working for free.
Oh, no. They're getting paid.
They're getting paid.
Yeah.
You know, so like Elizabeth Warren, when she talks about free college, but yet she's knocking down, six figures at Harvard. Wait, if she was really thinking about free college, she would be teaching for free.
Oh, yeah. Okay. For thee, but not for me.
Exactly.
That's a common refrain. And, there were so many of these professors where if you just ask them a simple question, do you have any skin in the game? Because if you have no skin in the game, then it's no skin off your back. That's one of the three questions I have learned to ask liberals. Question one, do you have any skin in the game? Question two, are we bringing people up or are we yanking them down? So when we talk about predicated on power structure, what it enables people to do is it enables them to yank them down without rising in any way, shape, or form. So let's say somebody like me, a white guy, I have dreadlocks in my hair. And somebody like Candace Owens, a black woman, or Condoleezza Rice have blonde highlights. Because predicated on power structure, only one of us is actually appropriating culture, right?
And that would be you with the dreadlocks.
Mm-hmm. And so because predicated on power structure, what would that enable them to do? It would enable them to take the dreads away from me, but what would happen to anyone else? Would they rise? Would they go up?
No,
they would remain exactly in place. And what does that mean? When it's not about me rising, but you falling, it's not about me winning, but you losing, and it's not about me having what you have, but about you not having it all together, that is the hallmark of the emotion of envy.
Aha. Now, what was the third thing? You said that there's three things that you always, ask someone.
Okay. You felt good, but did you do good? What were the results of your actions? So case in point, one of the things administrators and universities do is they love diversity. And so they make exceptions for diverse peoples to get into the schools. And what that often means is people who have lower scores and grades and resumes get admitted to schools that they wouldn't be able to get into on their own merit. What happens?
Basically, the quality of the graduates, their expertise, it goes down.
It goes down, but a lot of them don't graduate. A lot of them fail out.
So that's not really helping anybody.
You felt good.
Yeah.
But did you do good?
Okay. Okay. So.
No, we didn't.
Okay. So, hey, Stephen, on this podcast, we've got probably about 10 more minutes. This is a great conversation. What else do you want to make sure that we hit in this particular podcast?
Sure. So just quickly, we talked about the Federalist Papers, about, where they talked about equity. Number 5, Publius says, yet what human contrivance can secure the continuance of such equality? You know, he was saying, how do we make people equal? They also said, erroneously supposed that by reducing mankind to a perfect equality in their political rights, they would at the same time be perfectly equalized and assimilated in their possessions, their opinions, and their passions. That was number 10. So he's basically saying, like, look, we can't force people to be equals. There's one other point I wanted to make. I wanted to talk about what hoarding wealth means and where that really comes from. So Rousseau talks about the state of nature in the Second Discourse, and he says some really kind of preposterous things. One of those is that we lived as isolated, atomized individuals. We did not live with tribes, families, communities, villages, cities, or towns. Mom and dad would bump into each other once, would get to know each other biblically, and then mom would get pregnant. And then the moment we were big enough to fend for ourselves, like puppies, we would go off on our own. And because we lived as atomized, isolated individuals, Rousseau then makes this crazy leap in logic. He says something along the lines of, we would only take that which we desired at the immediate moment. So for example, if you're in the state of nature and you see an apple tree and there's two apples sitting on the ground next to the tree, you would only take one if and only if you were hungry at that exact moment. You would never say, well, not hungry now, but I might be later. Or, I don't even like apples, but Bob over there does. And, well, maybe if I were to barter with Bob, give him some apples, he could help me out. Didn't happen in the state of nature. And so he refers to it as some sort of perfect balance. Unfortunately, that balance was not maintained because someone said, mine. Acquired private property, and then used labor to acquire more private property. And that ruined the world. And his phrase for this was, iron and wheat civilized man, but ruined mankind. Karl Marx said something near identical, where he said that from each according to his needs, each according to his ability. That's what they mean by that phrase. Now, the contemporary iteration of that phrase is hoarding wealth. That's what they're really referring to when they say that they're hoarding wealth. That we don't need, why do you need one when you don't want any? Or, you know, why are you taking one when you don't need any? Why are you taking 10 when you only need one? Why does anyone need a million for anything ever, let alone a billion? And that's really what they're saying. What they're doing is they're ultimately calling into question the very concept of private property and possession.
And creating wealth, which has been such a great component of the American idea, is that everyday people could labor, they could make decisions, be responsible for their decisions, mm-hmm. and they could create wealth for themselves.
And what was the word you used to create wealth?
I forgot.
Labor.
Oh, labor. Okay.
And ultimately, what they're really saying, the socialists, why they're so obsessed with labor, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, that Nazi, sack of dog vomit in England, who was running the Labor Party, The Socialist Party is the Labor Party. The communist newspaper that I learned about from an episode of Seinfeld was called The Daily Worker. AOC is fighting for a living wage. Have you ever stopped to wonder what the connection is between socialism and labor? It's that they don't believe in original sin. And really what they're saying is not so much that labor doesn't exist, like it's the boogeyman, but that it must not exist as a mandatory and de facto aspect of the human condition.
But that's just not realistic.
Oh, no, it's nonsense.
Right.
And so what they did, what they're really saying is private property, labor, scarcity, the tragic nature of the human condition, those things don't need to exist. And that's really what socialism is in a nutshell. That scarcity, the first and foremost of all economic concepts, is not mandatory. That labor is not mandatory. That mine, private property, possession, is not mandatory. And that the human condition does not have to be tragic. It can be utopian.
And it's just not realistic. So we're about out of time. But on this apple example, so you go by.
Terrific.
And there's two apples. And at that point in time, you don't need one. You're not hungry or whatever. So you don't barter. You don't. You know, you don't get one.
Correct.
But the next hour, you are hungry, and you go back, and there are no apples, right? Because there is no private property. But if there's a farmer who has an orchard and realizes that there is a demand for apples, that people might want them, he might work extra hours. He might plant some more apple trees so that there are apples for people that want to buy them, right?
Yeah.
Or barter for them.
Yeah. Correct. Basically, what you're talking about is human nature. And ultimately, so much of liberalism is based on a fundamental misunderstanding or a belief, basically a whole set of ideology, beliefs, rules, systems that have been created on false notions of human nature.
Okay. One other thing I wanted to just kind of go back to before we close, and that is you said something about the individual, that they didn't really have our individuality.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Marx.
And so don't you see that with all this mandatory mask wearing? People are becoming, you don't know who they are. You can't smile at them.
Yeah.
It's making everybody kind of look the same.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's really what you would call mass man. So if you were to pay close attention to people like Alexis de Tocqueville, Tocqueville talked about, he's the guy who wrote Democracy in America in 1835, something along the lines. It was the single best book ever written about our country. It hasn't been equaled. Nothing has come close to it. He said that all of the middle institutions, the things that serve as a buffer between the individual and the state, the church, our families, our corporate trade unions, bowling leagues, you know, the Shriners clubs, all of these things have been disappearing and they've been eroded. Robert Nisbet, in a book called The Quest for Community, which was his big hit, talks about that. Robert Putnam hit the nail on the head in Bowling Alone. All of these things have been disappearing and nothing has come in their place to replace them. And when that happens...
Well, government.
Well, oh, correct. Correct. Robert Nisbet called it the Leviathan, but it's basically the idea that nothing has returned in their place of these middle institutions, and we are left with nothing separating man from government. And that's what mass man is. These people who are, it's not just a statistical number. It's a term meaning people who cannot associate. This was a major problem from the Industrial Revolution. If you were to read Benjamin Disraeli, former Prime Minister of England, he was a big conservative. He wrote a book called Sybil, or The Two Nations. He said, Christianity teaches you to love thy neighbor. The modern city acknowledges no such neighbor. And that's exactly, yeah, I never thought about the masks and mask man and mass man, but it's exactly it. Yes, correct.
Okay. Stephen Kessler, we're out of time for this podcast. We have a lot more to talk about, so I think we should schedule another one.
Yeah, sounds good to me. Always a pleasure to be here on the Kim Munson Show.
Okay, great. So this is Stephen Kessler, and again, people can find you where?
You can find me on The Imaginative Conservative, The American Thinker, The Vogelin View, and if anyone out there is a literary agent, I'm trying to push this manuscript. I think I have a winner.
I think you do too. So this is Kim Munson sounding off. God bless you, and God bless America.